Welcome to the Packet Pushers Podcast, a show about data networking. Today, we're going to jump into a conversation about Open vSwitch and performance enhancements that the core contributing team has baked into this thing, making it a packet forwarding animal. And before we get to that conversation, Greg, we were together in Barcelona, now we're an ocean apart again.
Things are improving. Sorry, wrong answer. I'm reading an article right now. Did you know that Pantone, that's the company who create reference colors? They decide what, you know all that sort of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Red is red and have and the color of the year for 2014 is Marsala. Did you know this?
I did not know this.
It's Pantone color 18-438. And I'm reading an article here which is pretty cool because Marsala is kind of like a red with all the fun taken out, right? And it actually says here, but somebody's come up with a much better description, the color of an old Band-Aid found behind the toilet, the color of a drunken mall Santa's outfit as he lies unconscious in the gutter. I like that one. But my favorite is the color of quivering heap of liver your mum won't let you leave the table without eating.
I love it.
I think all of those are the color of Lindsay Lohan's nicotine figures. Close, not so sure about that one, but yeah, it's always good to get a Lohan mentor reference into the packet pushers. We don't do that enough. I'll just make a note there, more Lindsay. I think that we need more color on a packet pushers, Ethan.
And masala, but not that color.
That's not masala. I'm not
sure.
That's
terrible. Color of the year, it may be, but it is not the vibrant tone that I am looking for to express the intellectual wherewithal exhibited by our audience.
I've had a shocking week. I've spent 2 days this week trying to build a VLAN trunk from a nodal L2 ECMP cluster, proprietary thing, the company doesn't exist, to a Dell S4810 with 40 gig, and then connect that to a Mellanox switch.
And the only reason the Dell's in the middle is because you couldn't get the nodal and the Mellanox to talk directly because of some sort of a 40 gig incompatibility, if I recall.
Yeah, that's right. When you plug the Brand X, the Mellanox 40 gig QSFPs together, it doesn't work, right? And if you plug the Intel, so we went and got some Intels, and we went through a half a dozen brand of QSFPs, and none of them work. But if I start plugging various other connectors in between the Mellanox to the Dell, and then the Dell to the nodal, it works. Same connectors, same whatever, works. So you know what? The IEEE, a pox on you and your sad little hobos that work in you making standards, because you guys made a standard that vendors can corrupt and turn into proprietary rubbish that can't be used in the field. Toe rags.
Wow, so we made it about 4 minutes in, and then you got up on your hobby horse.
Yeah.
Well done, sir. Well done.
I'm still angry about it. I wasted hours of pointless finger banging on the keyboard just because some donkey can't define a standard clearly enough so that a vendor can't do something stupid and corrupt it. Yes, I'm angry.
Tell us how you really feel. No, don't. Wait, don't.
Was I being too subtle?
Well, let's introduce our guests, some guys that have been writing code that hopefully doesn't make Greg any angrier. We have with us Ben Pfaff, Justin Pettit, and Ethan Jackson. These guys are core contributors to OVS, Open vSwitch. And starting with Ben, let's introduce all of you guys. Ben, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm excited to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, so my favorite color name these days is one that comes from Brazil. It's called Disappearing Donkey. And it's supposed to be the color of a donkey as it runs away from you.
Now there's a color I can get behind, Ethan.
Anyway, no, so I came into all of this out of Stanford, where I had met Martin, and he told me about some of his research. And then as I was graduating, he decided to recruit me for Nasira. And at Nasira, we didn't really know what we were doing at first, so we figured that out by creating something that turned into OpenFlow. And I was one of the people who designed some of the early versions of that. And I've continued to participate in the ONF's extensibility working group and continued to help evolve the protocol. So Open vSwitch is we like to think of as a way that you can program your network, and a lot of that happens through OpenFlow and through the extensions we've added to it, which take OpenFlow and turn it much more into something like a programming language.
Justin, introduce yourself, if you would.
All right, so I'm Justin Pettit. Before working on all of this stuff, I had a background on penetration testing and working on some of the early intrusion detection systems. And so I actually met Martin Casado in grad school, and I worked with him on some of the work that became OpenFlow, a project called Ethane.
Yeah.
And then we decided to do a company based on that. So I was a founding employee along with Ben and Martin, in Nasira. And so I was one of the early implementers of OpenFlow along with Ben, and wrote the original OpenFlow specification. And I continued to work on OpenFlow as vice chair of the extensibility working group in the ONF, which releases the OpenFlow specifications.
Great. Thank you for joining us as well. And then we have another Ethan on the show. I think this is the first thing this has ever happened. Ethan Jackson.
Hi. So I'm Ethan Jackson. I've been working on this stuff for 3 or 4 years. It was basically my second job out of undergrad. And I'm one of the core coders on the Open vSwitch project. And I sort of moonlight as a networking researcher, where I do a lot of thinking about SDN and network function virtualization and a bunch of random stuff. But that's pretty much my story at this point.
Good enough. Now, you all were pulled into Nasira through your connection to Martin, it sounds like. And so now, since Nasira was bought by VMware, you're all VMware employees?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, officially in my paycheck, it still says Nasira, but we work in VMware buildings with other VMware employees.
Yeah. There you go. Okay. Yeah. So
technical details.
This show started because of a post I saw on networkheresy.com where entitled Accelerating Open vSwitch to Ludicrous Speed. Now, before we get into the details of what you guys did to Open vSwitch to improve all that performance, I thought we'd get some background for the listeners, starting with, what is Open vSwitch?
So Open vSwitch is what we think of as a way to allow you to program your network. And we tend to think of that in terms of general purpose programming language. We would like it to be as convenient to program your network as it is to program applications on your computer. Now, the programming language that we have for that is not much like a programming language on your computer. It is an extended version of OpenFlow. So OpenFlow is probably a little more familiar to network admins than a normal programming language, because it works through a series of tables that look a little bit like ACL tables. And if you look at the usual way that OpenFlow is used, it's used a lot like all the tables in your ASIC, where you have a L2 table and you have an ingress ACL table and you have a VLAN table and so on. With Open vSwitch, we've extended the actions, we've extended the matches, so that you can you can actually argue that it's Turing complete in the same way as a normal computer or a normal programming language.
So when a network engineer thinks of a switch, typically they think of it's an Ethernet frame coming in that's getting switched, back out, and they think about VLANs, and they think about a lot of layer 2 stuff. Or if they think about a layer 3 switch, it's really routing, just something that's happening at ASIC speed. What you're describing with Open vSwitch is this is a virtual switch that does those things, but then a whole lot of other stuff too, depending on how heavy you want to get into it.
Sure, I guess I tend to think of it as not that it does all of those things, but you can tell it to do all of those things by programming in at a lower level.
Now, you guys are what I noticed is titled core contributors to Open vSwitch. Give us some background. What does that mean?
So I guess there's probably two aspects. So first of all, people who've contributed a significant amount to Open vSwitch can be nominated as committers. And that just means that they have direct access to the repository and can push their changes there after they've been properly reviewed. But I think when we say core contributor, we really just mean that each of us has contributed a lot of code to Open vSwitch.
You've got history.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I think, probably Ben, Ethan, and I, if you looked at the total number of commits, have the most, I'm guessing. We're probably the top three contributors to the OVS project.
Okay. So another question I have about Open vSwitch, just to set the background here, is what sort of networks care about Open vSwitch? I mean, this is a virtual switch. It's going to run on a hypervisor. Most network engineers listening to the show are thinking about hardware switches, top of rack switches, and core switches and such. How does Open vSwitch fit into the world? Who's running this thing? happening?
Well, today it's mostly happening in cloud environments where you have it typically runs as the virtual switch in the hypervisor of a cloud, so like an OpenStack cloud. And typically the model that we propose is something similar to a sort of standard VXLAN model where you move all of the high-level policy and functionality into the virtual switch, and that makes a decision about incoming packets, where to forward them, encapsulates the packet, and then just shoves it on a relatively dumb backplane. That's probably sort of the killer app for Open vSwitch now, but in the future, I would expect us to see it in more places, especially with network function virtualization sort of taking off. I wouldn't be surprised if Open vSwitch becomes the sort of de facto standard virtual switch for routing packets between VMs in that sort of environment. Mm-hmm. Also, to some extent, we use it as kind of a gateway between the network overlay and the wider internet. So it can sometimes be used as sort of a network appliance where there's no virtual machines running on it, but you just sort of use it to do your NATing and firewalling and all that sort of stuff.
It just aim packets at it, even though they're not destined for some virtual machine that's sitting on top of that hypervisor.
To be a little more clear, if you have like a VXLAN space and then you have the public internet, you need a box to take packets from the public internet and encapsulate them in VXLAN.
Sure.
Or do the reverse. Yeah.
So effectively, you're saying Open vSwitch can be a firewall, it can be a switch, it can be a router. So what we think of as in hardware abstract is, we have these different silicon devices that are supposed, some of them historically, like 10 years ago, the difference between a router and a switch was significant. Today, it's far less, differentiation. But, the things we put in our firewalls are load balancers, firewalls, switches, routers, and then we have the capability to do deep inspection in the engines, and that's where we start having hardware devices that do IPS and proxying and caching. And Open vSwitch, as a primitive concept or as a primitive function or redacted function, can do all of those things. It's fundamentally the asset that we would use inside of those things. Open vSwitch mirrors that capability.
In the long term, right now we can do switching and routing. Stuff like deep packet inspection is something that we definitely see us pursuing over the next couple of years.
Hmm. Conceptually, there's an ASIC inside of a firewall, there's an ASIC inside of a switch and a router that does packet forwarding or packet munging or packet frame forwarding. OVS is conceptually that same engine, just software.
Yeah, basically.
Right, and it's also a bit more flexible in terms of what it can match and what it can execute. Mm-hmm. But also, I just want to add that we have the ability to do ACLs as well as firewall features will be in the next version of Open vSwitch. And I think typically in a hardware switch, the ability to implement firewall policies are limited typically to stateless matches. And so we'll actually, on Linux anyway, be supporting connection tracking so that you can do a true stateful firewall with OVS.
Okay, right. This is where the difference creeps in. A hardware device is limited by what its hardware can achieve, right? You can't track flow state in an ASIC and get low latency. Your firewall is always doing it in software anyway. The state table is always held with a CPU and a memory. So when OVS does firewalling, it's still doing the same thing as your checkpoint, Cisco ASA, Fortinet firewall. It's just not it's also doing it in software as well. Those devices are the same. But, if you imagine an Open vSwitch is the same thing as, your Ethernet switch, router, ACL, then conceptually there's a parallel, if you like, between the two.
Yeah. There's one important, perhaps slightly subtle difference, which is a switching ASIC has context in that it knows that it's in its L2 stage or its L3 stage. Mm-hmm. Open vSwitch doesn't understand what it's doing. All it does is execute OpenFlow. And the L2 and L3 decisions are sort of encoded in the OpenFlow. So Open vSwitch itself is just a dumb OpenFlow interpreter, basically.
Well, that's true in the case that we usually deploy it, but Open vSwitch does have some of those abilities. So you can just by default, if you bring OVS up, it actually does act as a regular L2 learning switch. So it's capable of doing those things, but many of the deployments that where people use OVS is to hook it up to a controller where then all of those features are programmed as flows.
Okay, so this is probably a good point to start talking about how the OpenFlow table works in OpenVSwitch. So I think in plenty of other shows on Packet Pushes, we've talked about OpenFlow having flow entries, which is an extended tuple which has like source IP, destination IP, source MAC, destination MAC. You can have MPLS. You can match a packet on multiple criteria, and that is a flow. And a flow in the network, of course, is not just one packet. It's actually the entire exchange of packets from a source to a destination. So when your desktop connects to a web server, it doesn't just send one packet to the web server. It sends a stream of packets, usually hundreds. And the server has a TCP session coming back with its flow state coming back in the reverse direction. So there's two flow states in the network for your connection to the web server from the client to the server, and that is a flow of packets going backwards and forwards. Now, we talked about that plenty of times before in packet pushes, but I'm assuming that OpenFlow, the OpenVSwitch, has a massive flow table of OpenFlow entries. Is that fair?
That's correct. So there is this confusion that often occurs in OpenFlow and OpenVSwitch between an OpenFlow flow entry where it can match on any number of fields and a stream of packets. So we often try to clarify when we're talking about OpenVSwitch by calling a stream of packets a microflow.
Okay, so that's a designated flow. So you're saying for an extended flow entry, that's a flow because there can be many flows inside of a given table entry?
Right. A single flow table entry might match any number of microflows as they pass through the network.
Saying it can be very narrow, like an access list. It can match one IP address. It can match 16 million IP addresses.
Right. So you might have a flow that matches on all the packets destined to a particular MAC address, for example. Mm. So that's a very large potential number of microflows.
That would be called switching.
Yeah.
At that point, you're forwarding on destination MAC address. That's called switching.
Yes.
If you were matching to a single IP address, then that would be host-based routing. And if you were matching to a IP subnet, then that would be routing.
Right. If you had a single flow table that only matched on one of those fields, as you said, then that would be what it is. Usually, there's a whole series of flow tables that a packet flows through, and at one stage, you might match on only one of those fields.
So in traditional or legacy networking, you match an access list and then you egress the table, the lookup finishes. In an open flow, it can cascade down to other rules or flow further down the table?
It would normally cascade to the next table in the sequence. You can think of an open flow table as analogous to one stage that a packet passes through in an ASIC. So you might have a table that checks for admissibility for ingress, another one that checks the ingress VLAN, another one that does MAC learning, another one that looks up the destination MAC, and so on.
And there might be just like the way that you combined access lists in a normal in a physical device, inbound interface, outbound interface, match, and different actions might apply depending on how the rules are processed. So conceptually, something like that.
Absolutely.
Right. You know, I really should go back and get that OpenFlow book finished.
You should.
So with the VMware controller, we routinely push down hundreds of thousands of flows into OpenVSwitch. So it's really we're only constrained by the amount of memory that in terms of the number of OpenFlow rules that can be pushed down into OVS. So that you know these flow tables can be massive, and when a packet comes in with NSX, for example, there are dozens of layers or table lookups that need to occur to process and figure out what needs to happen to the packet.
Well, now this gets into some of the performance challenges that I was reading about, I think. Why don't we take a step back and, you know, when a packet flows into OVS, it can match on an open flow rule, or if there's nothing there, what a typical network engineer works on Cisco gear, let's say, would think of as it gets punted. It's handled either by the kernel or it's handled by in user space by OVS vSwitchD. Can you talk about those two things, then tie that back into the open flow tables and the rules that are there?
I think of it as a caching hierarchy. That your first step in the caching hierarchy is the kernel, And if the kernel doesn't know what to do with it, then it sends it to user space. And in some cases, the controller might not have even programmed in what user space is supposed to do with it. So user space then sends it to the OpenFlow controller. So in Outline, it's a caching hierarchy.
And you know, we haven't really talked much about the controller, but that is a key part of all of this. We were talking earlier about how Open vSwitch is going to work in an OpenStack environment where typically you're using OpenStack to build infrastructure as a service, multi-tenancy, and you've got a controller that's telling Open vSwitch what he's going to do. I just did a very elaborate hand gesture that no one can see. It was very pretty. And so we're not, as network engineers, programming Open vSwitch to do these things and adding OpenFlow rules and all that. There's a controller that's doing all this in the background for us. We're really talking about the nuts and bolts of what's happening between the controller and Open vSwitch.
That's right. It would be pretty advanced for a network engineer to start designing the OpenFlow flow tables themselves. There's no reason that one couldn't. But I expect that most deployments in practice will use some sort of prepared controller that's designed for whatever use case is present in the network environment.
And that's the value of a controller, is that it says, I want to put in a MAC forwarding rule, and it calculates maybe 10, 20 rules or something to do that, and then loads them into switch 1, 2, 3, 4 in the path to make that happen.
Absolutely. And
to take a simple use case, sorry, just to take a very, yeah.
Right. So I remember listening to some of the other Packet Pushers podcasts and hearing about the frustration with having to configure a lot of individual network elements in your network. And if OpenFlow and Open vSwitch fulfill their promise, then that should alleviate a lot of that problem, because you're only configuring one controller through some sort of northbound interface or GUI, and then that controller goes and programs all of your network elements for you instead of having to program them individually as network engineers.
It can be physical or software or, you know, whatever it is that they need to be. It doesn't matter. The controller doesn't care whether it is. It just uses it.
Right. So the controller might be controlling mostly OpenFlow elements, but there's no reason that the controller couldn't interface with other elements in your network that are programmed different ways. For example, a VTEP that's mm-hmm. programmed through the OVS VTEP scheme.
Yeah, an Arista EOS switch doing VXLAN termination, or a Fortinet firewall if they ever implemented an API, and we could configure that from the controller too.
Right. Our focus in Open vSwitch has been mostly on hypervisors that do switching and software, but Open vSwitch also has the ability to be ported to hardware ASIC-based switches, and we know that that's happened in some places. Sometimes you can tell if you look at the OpenFlow implementation on some switch that you have, ask it to identify itself. Sometimes the vendors don't change the identifying strings, and they will actually report that they're running Open vSwitch. Hmm.
Yeah, I was actually working on a Dell switch this week, as I ranted about earlier, and it actually, in the interface, you can actually drop it into OpenFlow mode. It's just right there. You go conf t in da-da-da-da, OpenFlow, and it's an OpenFlow interface. They're actually doing both OpenFlow and normal forwarding.
Right, and one of the disappointments with some OpenFlow ASIC switches is that they may not be able to provide as general functionality as Open vSwitch, because they're limited to the abilities of their ASICs, of course.
Yeah, the ASIC might only match on a certain set of tuples, and it might only be able to handle so many entries in the flow table. Anyway, that's probably a discussion for another day. Let's let the wheels of SDN rotate a little further before we get.
So early in the days of Open vSwitch, as I was reading you guys chronicle the history, you were talking about how you quickly ran into a scaling problem because Open vSwitch really only dealt with microflows. We've kind of talked about what that is. We want to say what that is, and then the strategy that was taken to overcome that limitation.
So the way that historically OVS worked is that there's this kernel module and there's the user space. And all the OpenFlow rules are up in user space, and the kernel is just a very fast cache. So in a hardware switch, you have a TCAM, which allows you to wildcard various entries and find out what actions you should apply. In software, that's a lot harder to do efficiently. So the original implementation of OVS, there was a hash table. Hash tables are very easy to implement in software. And so what would happen is a packet would come in, we'd pull all the headers off that we could match on, and then we would run a hashing function on that and then look to see in the hash table whether there was an entry. And if there was, then we would apply those actions. And if there wasn't, we'd punt it up to user space. And so the thing with a hash table is that you have to know all of the entries. You can't have any wildcards. It doesn't have the flexibility of a TCAM. Hmm. And so this initial implementation would be that you know, a packet would come in, we'd pull the headers off, would miss an entry, send it up to user space, then user space could have those hundreds of thousands of OpenFlow rules that we talked about, and then figure out what would happen to the packet. And that could be that processing to look into what should happen to the packet could be quite expensive because there could be many stages of that pipeline defined. And so that's why we wanted to implement this cache. Once you'd figure out what to do with that packet, we would push down an exact match entry into OVS or into the kernel module. And that worked well if you didn't have very short-lived flows, which if you had, you know, quote-unquote well-behaved traffic, the caches would heat up in the kernel and then everything would work great. But if someone came in and did something like a port scan or some cloud applications that create lots of very short-lived flows to each other, you could end up missing lots of packets in the kernel and have to send that up into user space. And that's where we started really seeing problems when we deployed this in cloud environments where, you know, you don't necessarily control what kind of traffic is being generated, and OVS's user space component could end up choking on trying to process all of those packets. And that's where we came up with the idea of introducing megaflows. And so megaflows allow us in the kernel to do wildcarding. So it's a little bit more like a TCAM in that you can have various fields that are wildcarded. And so what happens now is that packet comes in, we look in the Megaflow cache, which supports wildcarding, and we can get into the implementation of that if you're interested in how we do that. But then if that misses, we send it up to user space. And then as we're going through those OpenFlow tables, we look at which fields were matched. And so we assume that basically all the fields can be wildcarded. But if we match on something in the OpenFlow rule, then that must be of interest for the policy that's being implemented. And so Ben hates this term, but unwildcard that field so that it becomes matchable in the kernel module. So for example, if you just turned on an L2, if you're just doing L2 switching, then the only fields that would matter would be the destination MAC and the VLAN. So we would push down a wildcard entry down into the kernel that looks at those two fields. However, if you wanted to do routing, then you would end up looking at some of the L3 fields. And so then as you look at more fields, those megaflows become more specific down into the kernel. So we dynamically adjust how many fields are wildcarded based on the policies that are implemented in OpenFlow.
But you don't have to do lookups across every field or every tuple that's there in this scenario. You only have to look at the things that are interesting.
Correct. Exactly. And that's what we based on the policies, based on the flows that were written, then we dynamically figure out which are the fields that we're interested in matching into the kernel so that we enforce correctness.
Okay. And so there's a big amount of scale that you're gaining there, because now you're processing a lot more in the kernel and not having to punt to user space. So you're getting the ability just to push more traffic through OVS.
Yeah, and right. A lot of the optimizations we've done in the past year, once you have this software TCAM interface for the data path, this Megaflow interface, the optimization work switches from making the slow path fast to making the slow path wildcard as many bits as possible. And a lot of this sort of ludicrous speed we're getting is coming from really complicated advanced algorithms to avoid wildcarding bits whenever possible. And if you do have to wildcard a bit, you want to wildcard bits in like the Ethernet header instead of bits in like the TCP source port, because you want to wildcard bits that are unlikely to change between packets flowing through the switch.
I think you mean unwildcard.
Now, are there traffic patterns where mega flows are less efficient or don't make a lot of sense, or is it worked out well in all your testing?
It, practically speaking, it works quite well. Packet classification, so building this software TCAM is an NP hard problem. It's very, it's just impossible to do efficiently. So one can construct very, very weird traffic patterns that would not perform very well. But with real traffic in the deployments that we've done at VMware, the performance has been really fantastic.
Yeah, and real performance. I mean, you, if I remember right, you did some testing where it was a multi-tenant data center with 1,000 hypervisors or something like that, and you put it through its paces in that sort of an environment. And I think the guys from Rackspace were talking about this, the performance gains they were seeing too, since they've turned this up.
Yeah,
yeah, that's right. And so what they were saying is that, and they presented this at OpenStack, and then we had an OVS conference about a month ago, and so they presented their results of upgrading to the newest versions of Open vSwitch. And so previously, in some of their environments, OVS was a bottleneck in their network. And now, since they've run the latest versions of OVS, they're actually the performance bottlenecks that they're seeing are in other parts of the system that are unrelated to OVS.
So we're not the
bottleneck anymore.
Yeah.
So when you say system, do you mean the operating system? Are you talking about the Unix socket or the TCP stack or the network adapter?
Right. I think in particular they were mentioning that they use Zen Server in their deployments, and there's this net front, net back, which are responsible for taking packets from the VM and then handing them to the hypervisor, and that's now one of the bottlenecks that they highlighted. That I know, and I know Citrix is working on improving that, but that's no longer is OVS the bottleneck. There are other places.
Yeah,
that are,
it's the old story. You unbottleneck it in one place, only to find it somewhere else. But
of course,
eventually you start unbottlenecking the next one, and then you start to get results. And that's iterative. That's how we've worked in computing for the last 20 years. This isn't this is how it works.
Megaflows wasn't the only thing that you did to improve performance. There's been other things that you've done over time as well. One of them was multi-threading.
So the data path cache has always been multi-core. Packets are handled by the core that receives them, the core that the interrupt for that packet ends up on. For a long time, the slow path was a single-threaded process.
This is OVS vSwitch-D.
Yeah, OVS vSwitch-D was a single-threaded process. And this has two problems. The obvious problem is if you have a 8-core box, you can't take advantage of all that CPU. And then a probably less obvious problem is OVS vSwitch-D had to do a bunch of bookkeeping and accounting work. It had to maintain the database. It had to send BFD tunnel monitoring packets, had to do all this stuff.
He's effectively the control plane, what network engineers think of as the control plane, doing all that stuff as well as simple packet forwarding.
Exactly.
And so you got one thread here, and you got all this stuff that can queue up in line. It could be control plane traffic, and you're waiting to make a decision on how to forward a packet, slowing things up.
Right, right. Yeah, and we would have problems where packet forwarding would get blocked on database log writes. Which is not what you want. So what we ended up doing was breaking the switch into a bunch of different kinds of threads. There's still a single thread that does all the bookkeeping work. Then there's a thread which is responsible for what we call mishandling. And all that is if the data path doesn't know what to do with the packet, it hands the packet to the mishandling thread. And that thread's sole job in life is to listen for these packets, figure out what to do with them, and forward them, and install a cache entry.
So there's one point about performance that I especially like to make with people who come from a traditional networking background, and that is that if you're building an appliance switch, if you're building a dedicated switch, then if you can handle line rate on all of your interfaces, then performance is good enough. You've won. For a hypervisor switch, for a switch where you've got tasks to do other than forwarding packets, the story is a bit different.
In other words, it's a hypervisor CPU you're sharing with a bunch of other processes. It's not just forwarding packets. It's also dealing with all the guests that are living up there and so on.
That's right. If you forward all your interfaces at line rate, but you've used up all of your 8 cores of CPU, right. Then
you have not nobody's won, going to be fact, happy you've with lost. You. Yeah,
that's right. So we're very sensitive to CPU usage as well as to performance.
And what's cool about this multi-threading work is you can give us as many threads as you want, and the performance will increase roughly linearly with the number of cores you give us. But even if you only give us a single core for forwarding packets, the number of CPU cycles we spend per packet forwarded has dropped dramatically as a result of improved architecture. Basically, the switch is more efficient, and that's been enabled by this new multi-threaded architecture.
And just to be clear, the multi-threading that we're talking about here is the user space portion, which handles which is the mishandler. So if packets are hitting the flow cache, they never get sent up to user space to have to deal with any of the multi-threading. So if we have very good mega flows, then there's a reduced amount of packets that are having to be processed in user space.
Right. So it's this multi-tiered architecture. It all works together to improve scale, across the board. The more stuff that hits and can be processed at kernel, then the fewer packets that make it up to user space, and then the multi-thread. But if it does, the multi-threading that's in user space improves performance there.
Correct.
On the other hand, though, we're seeing vast improvements in DRAM speed, CPU speed. Intel's got the DPDK toolkit, which is now offering performance-enhanced hardware acceleration for networking features like DPDK 1.6 and 1.7 offering. And there's features in the motherboard, in the CPU, and in coprocessors which offer acceleration for networking functions. Are they scheduled for OVS in the future?
It's an active area that we're working on. So, for example, the Intel had done the OVDK, which was their open vSwitch on DPDK. And so we began working with them probably 6 months ago on doing a port of OVS, something that would be in our mainline. And that work went very well, and they actually have ended the OVDK project, and they're using the OVS DPDK work that's in the mainline of OVS. So, we really are, the main interest that we have is in making fast programmable switches that are controlled by software. And then under that, we don't really have any preference. If it's using DPDK, the Linux kernel, or hardware, we're happy as long as there's software control over those elements.
Yeah, it's the ability to program the vSwitch is what matters here. This idea of saying, here's my list of flows and how I want, just take those and do something with them. Whether the OVS uses DPDK to use hardware acceleration inside the Intel or not, it's not vital to the success of the project or not the current target of the project.
Well, and so this is an active area of work that we're doing. So we have a couple of engineers that are working on the DPDK port. Ethan has been actively looking into some of the new features on NICs and motherboards to accelerate forwarding. We've always used whatever capabilities are available on the system. So for a long time, we've supported hardware offloads for transmitting packets whenever we can. So whenever those features become available, we always make use of them. Fact, now we've gotten to the point where we're starting to talk to the hardware vendors and make suggestions about how they might be able to make it more amenable to software forwarding, some of the features that they have.
So conceptually then what we're seeing is that OVS has gone from being a user space module, which was fundamentally sat on top, to being in the kernel, so speed and performance from being in the kernel. Now you've made these ludicrous performance gains by using fancy algorithms. We probably should talk a little bit more about the algorithms and the way you've sped this up a little bit. And then the next stage now is to say it's in the kernel, it's as fast as it's going to get in software. You've optimized the software itself to be accelerated. The next one is probably to start saying there's some different ways we could go from here. One of them is hardware, the other one is to do more, more optimizations on the software and so on. So it's just this iterative process going forward to get more speed. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, I think so.
Let's talk a little bit about the hardware support that we're hoping for. So, one of the most promising areas, in my opinion, is that for us, one of the expensive parts in the kernel or in user space is figuring out what flow is the best match for a packet. we're looking at some NICs that are coming out that can actually keep a flow table or part of a flow table on NIC, and then when they pass the packet to us in the kernel or in user space, they can just tell us which flow was the best match for the packet, and we can take it from there.
And I wanted to make the point that what we really want out of hardware optimizations is to maintain the flexibility of software. So we don't want to end up in a world where we offload everything to hardware but lose the programmability. And the real challenge here is figuring out what primitives we can move to hardware and what we can keep in software. So we end up with a hybrid approach that's faster than software is on its own, but much more programmable than hardware is on its own. That's sort of the holy grail over the next 2 years that we're aiming for.
So I think of this as somewhat analogous to a long time ago. There were terminals were really important, and so there were dumb terminals, and then there were there was a generation of smart terminals, but you don't want them to do too much, because then you can't make them do the smart things. So you want a smart terminal, not a smart ass terminal.
No, I want a smart ass terminal. I want that. When I press return, it goes, "What the?" I want to see that. You know, or you know, DOS. Why does it never say, "That's a great DOS command"?
That holy grail that you're talking about—that combination of really capable software yet offloading functions to hardware to scale better, get better performance out of it—is that the kind of thing that only happens by working with the silicon manufacturers for specific functions that they build in ASIC? Or is that the kind of a thing that do FPGAs factor into this at all?
Yeah, I mean, this is still sort of very early work, but if I could give you an analogy, and this is, I'm fairly young, so this is all like before my time, but apparently, sorry. I
didn't know. Ethan likes to bring that up a lot.
Yeah. I the first Ethernet I ever used was 1 gigabit, to give you a sense of my age.
You burst into our office once and you declared, "Did you know that Ethernet once came in 100 megabit?"
So anyway,
I once installed 1 meg Ethernet on shielded pair. Not twisted, just shielded.
If that was all 100 megabit Ethernet, fast Ethernet, still blows my mind a little bit. But
dude, I was there. It was fast.
As an analogy, what I want is something similar to what happened in graphics. So a graphics card is super general, right? And with a graphics card, we can do all these sort of cool graphics things, but it doesn't have to be special purpose built for the particular graphics application you're using. What I really want to see in networking is something similar happen where the hardware gives us some primitives.
There's a universal API, and then somewhere underneath it, the hardware acceleration there, it just works.
Right,
if it's not there, it just runs slower and so on and so forth.
Exactly.
Yeah. And if you've got the hoop-de-doo graphics card, it goes hoop-de-doo fast.
Exactly. Rather than having a special ASIC built for each application, you know, some new protocol appears and we have to...
That's why I referred to DPDK. The Intel DPDK seems to be the only way we're going to get hardware acceleration for, you know, any networking functions on the motherboard. And Intel's iterated over it for 5 years, so it's not like they're going to Google it, you know what I mean, by killing it after a little while. Like plenty of that. You know...
The DPDK functionality, I think, is sort of separate from the hardware. So, I mean, they may expose some of those capabilities, but a lot of those they're working with the Linux kernel community to also expose them to the kernel as well. So, I'm not sure if they're at odds with each other, the Linux kernel and the hardware support versus DPDK.
No, not. You know, what I'm saying is Intel's been iterating on DPDK for quite some time.
Yeah. So they're clearly interested in improving software forwarding on general purpose processors. That's
clearly interesting. I mean, the only way they could make it more clear is to fly a little plane up with a big message on it. In all honesty, it's not clearly. I mean, they want to sell more CPUs, and if they can do it in hardware, guess what? They sell more CPUs. Hoo-ah.
Right.
one of the things about DPDK that interests me is that it's sort of an existence proof that you can do this quickly. And now the question is, why can't we do this as quickly in the Linux kernel? And I really expect a lot of what's been learned from that work to be pushed back into the kernel networking stack so that we can see much faster networking there as well.
So we've talked a lot about how OVS has, how you guys have done performance improvements to OVS to really, boost how much traffic you can push through the thing. Okay, what does that look like in the real world? I mean, you guys got some numbers, some points of comparison you could bring to us?
Oh, absolutely. So we've got this paper that we submitted to NSDI 15 and was accepted. So that has an evaluation section, and let's talk through some of the numbers we've got there. One of the important points of comparison that a lot of people care about is Open vSwitch as fast as the alternatives? And the best alternative to compare against is the Linux bridge, because that has a sort of a related architecture, and it should strictly be faster than OVS from a lot of points of view, because every packet that goes through the Linux bridge, which runs in the Linux kernel, gets switched directly, and there's no user space slow path for it to go to. So we did some comparisons with fairly complex flow tables in Open vSwitch, which means that it's doing a lot more work than the Linux bridge. So in our comparisons, we found that they had identical throughput in our configuration, which was approximately 20 gigabits per second, and they had approximately the same connection rates that they could handle, which in each case was about 700,000 connections per second. When we used the simplest configuration for the Linux bridge, Open vSwitch used more CPU than Linux bridge. However, when we added one simple IP tables rule to the Linux bridge, suddenly the Linux bridge connection rate dropped, and its CPU usage increased 26-fold. And so, when we made the similar change to the Linux to the Open vSwitch flow table, nothing changed at all. Hmm. So, if you're trying to do anything complex with the Linux bridge, unless we triggered some bug that can be fixed or whatever, then Open vSwitch is going to perform much better for you.
Just as soon as you get into any sort of complexity, which naturally with OpenFlow, that's the whole point. You can do all kinds of clever processing on the flows going through the engine.
Right. The IP tables rule that we added just dropped STP BPDUs. It wasn't anything complex.
And not even something it should be seeing that many of either.
Right. Yeah. It really should have no significant effect.
Hmm. Okay. So it scales up. Yes, you can see some CPU usage. What does CPU usage look like, on an aggregate, for the hypervisor? How much is Open vSwitch using?
So for our case where we were doing the 20 gigabits, we were seeing Open vSwitch use about a core and a half at that point. Most of that, I believe, was actually in kernel flow forwarding.
Yeah, a core and a half, meaning this was on an 8-core CPU.
I think this was 8-core. It might have been 16-core. My notes say that it had 2 8-core Xeons.
Okay, so it's scaled across two 8-cores. So it's low CPU is the point here. Single digit.
There's still plenty of CPU left for the application to run, for the operating system and the actual app.
Right, and that amount of CPU use is not typical, because usually your hypervisor isn't doing 20 gigabits of traffic. What we consider to be normal is 5% CPU or less.
Okay. So, acceptable. You're getting a feature in the operating system. I regard 5% CPU as perfectly acceptable trade-off. You're getting Open vSwitch with a whole bunch of functions, usually things like, if you're doing it right, you should have some security. You're getting routing, path forwarding, maybe some overlay networking at the edge in the server. You're getting a whole bunch of flexibility to burn 5% of the system itself. That's a real win for cloud providers especially.
That's the way we look at it, and so one of the things we're reporting in the paper is that we got some statistics from a real cloud provider that had over 1,000 hypervisors, and on 80% of those, the average use was 5% or less, and over half of them used 2% CPU or less on average.
And those are real world cloud providers, people that have got presumably as big a scale as OVS is ever likely to see.
That's right. It's one of the largest deployments that we know about, although, of course, there can be any number of deployments that we don't know about.
Now, when we were talking offline, you had mentioned BFD, bidirectional forwarding detection, as one of the protocols you used that you were kind of pleased with as far as how the scale worked out.
Yeah, I mean, it's taken a lot of time to get there. But if you think about an overlay network, you have this problem where you have certain nodes in the network that might have a tunnel to everyone else in the network. So we'll have our gateway nodes will have on the order of 10,000 tunnels going to them. And the real cost with a tunnel is monitoring the tunnel. So if a tunnel dies because of a link failure or the server on the other end of the tunnel conked out or whatever, you need to know both so you can notify the network administrator and take alternative paths. And a lot of work has gone into making the monitoring of these tunnels scale. Because if you imagine you have 10,000 tunnels, each of which is sending and receiving a tunnel monitoring packet every 300 milliseconds.
So that's the way BFD works. Is BFD is the open vSwitch itself has to forge a packet. When I say forge, make. I mean, why do I use the word forge? has to generate the BFD packet and then transmit it out of the interface based on some internal. So it has to do a database lookup, say, I'm going to do this out this interface and send it down this virtual tunnel. And you're saying doing that every 300 milliseconds, and then it's got to receive the ones from the 10,000 tunnels and respond back, you know, and so on. And then also analyze what that BFD data set means. If something's gone down, then it has to trigger and pass it off. So there's quite a bit of work actually being done with BFD and presumably it's done in the kernel, because in a physical switch, BFD frames are actually generated in the interface chip, not
Actually, for us, it's not done in the kernel. It's done in vSwitch-D. The reason being that we want to keep the kernel as simple as possible, and we don't want to add this sort of application-specific logic to it. You're exactly right that it's extremely expensive to have vSwitch-D waking up all the time to handle these packets and waking up all the time to forward these packets. And we've done a bunch of optimizations to make this scale. When we started this work, it barely scaled to, you know, a couple thousand tunnels. Now we're at the point where we can pretty easily handle 10,000 tunnels. We don't really have many deployments larger than that, so we kind of stopped once we got there. we're a single server has 10,000 tunnels. At that point, you're like, network, if you've got 30,000 tunnels, your network architecture is wrong.
in which case, there's somebody out there doing it wrong, right? probably more than one.
Yeah. So there's a couple of optimizations we've done. An obvious optimization is we put all the BFD handling in its own thread. So like I said earlier in the podcast, if you isolate work into its own thread, then it can't get blocked behind database writes and various other bookkeeping stuff. So that helped a lot. And then there's a bunch of sort of clever things we did where, if you imagine, if you're a node and you have 10,000 tunnels coming to you, most of those tunnels are not sending any traffic ever, right? It's very unlikely that you have a single node where everyone in the network is talking to that node concurrently. So we did some work where a node can request those tunnels that are not receiving data traffic to lower their BFD transmission and reception rate. Okay. Which greatly helps the scale.
That would require a signaling capability to the other end to let them exchange the data rate process.
Yeah, and all that we did sort of using clever techniques that allowed us to do that without breaking the BFD standard.
Yeah.
So we could attach our BFD implementation to a completely standard Cisco or Arista implementation and still perform this work within the standard. Yeah.
Let me just back off. BFD is really important inside of a tunnel, so people who are listening, because the tunnel itself has no way of knowing if the network between it's gone down. So if you're sending keep-alives down there between two vSwitches every 300 milliseconds and then they start dropping, then you know the path is degrading for some reason. There's packets being dropped in the path. And if you stop receiving BFD, then you know that the path end-to-end path has failed and you need to take down the tunnel. Or signal to the vSwitch that the tunnel has failed for some reason and to stop forwarding packets down it. That's the basic reason.
Yeah, exactly.
That's also called frame relay. Okay. Yeah. Just in case you young fellows who maybe never heard of that, that's called frame relay.
I've heard this term, but I've never looked it up.
I'm joking, by the way. Please. Yeah. I just wanted to. There's nothing new in networking.
Yeah, exactly.
PVCs.
Well, and BFD is not the first. Before BFD, we implemented a protocol called CFM.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there are protocols that existed to do this before CFM.
Yeah, sorry, I'm not jabbing at you. I'm just
yeah. No, it's fine. But CFM is a really sort of nasty, difficult to understand, difficult to implement protocol. And
Probably seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
There's probably somebody's research program says, somebody said, you know, we should really just, somebody's already done all this, we'll just use that. Actually, this isn't such great after all.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, actually, I mean, that implementation, when I first started at Nasir, it was sort of a hazing ritual. I was the one who had to implement it because no one else wanted to. That quality of service.
Yeah. Yeah. However, I do remember how you kept getting bug reports in your CFM implementation that when we tried to track them down, it turned out that it was actually just reporting that the link was down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if you own the tunnel monitoring protocol for your network virtualization solution, every bug QA finds comes to you. Because any bug in the system, the tunnels go down. So, like, I got this really deep understanding of NSX, which was not great, but there it is.
That's like the networking guy can often debug storage problems or application problems because whenever they don't work, it's the networking guy who's got a problem.
Yeah.
That's called the turd runs downhill.
So guys, what's the future look like for OVS? I mean, are there project priorities that you've got right now?
Well, so I mean, probably the most interesting stuff that we're working on right now is related to doing deeper inspection of the packets, more stateful services. So, we mentioned that we realized that we had this performance issue a couple years ago, and that was really the focus for the entire team for this time. And now we're getting back to actually working on features. And so I'd mentioned earlier that we're adding the ability to do stateful firewall services by leveraging the connection tracking utility in the or kernel module on Linux. And we're starting to go down that path. So I think we're going to see support for NAT, some basic DPI matching. And you know, that's probably the most obvious direction that we're going. We're continuing to look at improving performance, the work that Ethan's doing on the hardware acceleration, and then also the DPDK work. Those are kind of the main areas of focus that we have right now.
And you guys live within Nasira/VMware, and is this what you guys do full-time, is work on OVS?
Yeah, we have there's a team of about, I should know this, but since I'm the team lead, but they're, I think, 11 developers, and that's what we do full-time, is work on OVS.
And then there are developers outside of VMware, too, who are
right.
Competitors.
Mm. Yeah,
there's other companies who contribute. There's other companies. Yes. And I doubt there's too many people who aren't being paid to do this because it's fairly full-time.
We do get some contributions from academia, but they're many fewer than the ones from other companies.
Awesome.
Well, that sounds like a good place for us to wrap up this podcast. So as we do that, let's go around the table one more time. And Ben, starting with you, if you've got a blog or a Twitter handle or anything you'd like to plug, go ahead and do that. How can people reach you on the internet?
You can reach me at blp@nicira.com or on Twitter at @ben_faff. And I'm always happy to hear from anyone.
Wow, he gave out his email address and everything. That's feel the power right there, listeners. And Justin, how about you? Same question.
All right. Yeah, I'm accessible from jpettit@nasira.com, and my Twitter handle is Justin_D_Pettit.
Thank you very much. And then Ethan Jackson.
Yeah, rather surprisingly, I'm not on Twitter, being the youngest person.
Yeah, Twitter's been around for so long. I mean, I wouldn't get on that thing.
I know. Yeah, it's too advanced for me.
It's too old for you.
It might be fast writing or something. Is that, no, yeah. frame. No, I don't know.
But I'm happy to receive emails at ethan@nasira.com.
Very good. Well, thanks to the three of you for coming on the show today. And any parting thoughts, Mr. Farrell?
I hate QSFPs and IEEE.
You open with that thought and you're closing with that thought. Very good.
Yeah, you can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com. On the Twitter is at etherealmind, although I'm very quiet these days. I am tired from a long year and very busy wrapping up into Christmas, and I've got some stuff happening on the personal front. So I apologize if you're not seeing the usual torrent of content from me, and hopefully I'll be back in January.
Very good. And I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. You can follow me on my blog, ethancbanks.com. And this, of course, has been the Packet Pushers podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers or send us an email, packetpushers@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. We do our very best to respond to every single email that comes in. And that is actually true. It's just sometimes it takes a while. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.